Good evening, everybody. This is Josh Placer from GameWisdom.com. Welcome to another exciting episode of the Perceptive Podcast, where we examine the art and science of games. We got a great cast for you this week. Our topic tonight is going to be talking about Sky Shines Bedlam. This was a roguelike game released in September of last year, and unfortunately it was met with a lot of negative reviews. And what the developers did was to actually continue working on the game, making improvements suggested by the community, and recently re-released the title. So we're going to talk about the challenges of essentially trying to fix a game after release and the decision-making that goes into it tonight. So please welcome from Skyshine Games, the designer who worked on Skyshine's Bedlam, Jeff Johnson.
Hello.
Hi, Jeff. It's great to have you on tonight.
It's good to be here.
So as I was saying, it's definitely been a very interesting trip for you and Skyshine's Bedlam over the last year.
Yeah, I think that's an understatement, but yeah.
So to get things started, before we start talking about the design as a focus, for people listening to the cast who may not have picked up on Skyshine's Bedlam or have been following the news, could you tell us a little bit about your background and what Skyshine's Bedlam is?
Well, my background is I've been doing video games on and off now for a good 25 years. Mm-hmm. Started back in the old days of doing pinball, and then video arcade machines. Worked on NFL Blitz and a lot of sport games back in the day. Mm-hmm. Took a 10-year hiatus, did business software of all things, and then came back to games. A couple of my friends, the other owners of Skyshine, who I've worked with before, called me out of the blue and said, "Hey, we're thinking about doing another game." And Bedlam was the outcome of that. Mm-hmm. After about a year, we started by doing a Kickstarter, and that went over really well. And then we spent the last about a year after that, I think, to finish the game. Mm-hmm. And then, like you said already, when we released last September, it was met with so-so feedback due to its interesting game mechanic. Mm-hmm. But then since then, we kind of went back, like you said, and did a redux.
Yeah. And I know we just said that you worked, that it was released in September of last year. For people listening, when did the redux upgrade come out for Skyshine's Bedlam?
March 16th, I think it was. Right around St. Patty's Day.
All right. So
it was a good 6 months after initial release.
Yeah.
But we did do a quick update after we launched to kind of hopefully put some, like, a band-aid on the bleeding, if you will. Mm-hmm. We did a version 2.0 to mitigate some of the issues people were having, but it wasn't enough. Mm-hmm. So we kind of hunkered down and tried to figure out what to do next.
Yeah. And that's one of the more interesting developments, especially with game development over the last few years, with developers allowing for a lot more transparency and also a lot more post-release support. We're seeing games and game designers work on these titles post-release, but examples like Skyshine's Bedlam, where you, as you're saying, you had to try to stem the bleeding and then you decided to do almost a restoration of the design, those examples come few and far between. And I'm sure for any developers listening, especially those who have gone the early access route or the post-release support route, I'm sure that your thoughts and your experience on this will be a very interesting listen to them.
Yeah, we've had several, if you want to talk internal talks about what, if anything, we did wrong or if we could have done anything differently. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have said, well, why didn't you go early access? Because we did not. Like, we spent a year after Kickstarter, and we thought it was ready. Mm-hmm. We got a lot of positive feedback from the press and all the syndicates. Like, we went to E3, mm-hmm. tons of positive feedback. So we were blindsided when we released it. And then the public, or the game players, if you will, the players, mm-hmm. had almost a completely 180 review of the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that is definitely one of the interesting points. I was talking to my friend and contributor to Game Wisdom, James Ellery, the other day, and he was asking me, "Josh, you play a lot of these challenging games. Why do you think all this trouble happened with Skyshine's Bedlam?" And I was also a little bit confused as well, because we've seen a lot of roguelike and a lot of challenging games being released over the last 4 or 5 years. I mean, hell, The Binding of Isaac is one of my all-time favorite games, not to mention, you know, the Dark Souls line, all that stuff. And it's definitely very tricky, especially with the consumer these days, to make a game that's explicitly challenging. Something like Dark Souls, where you're expected to lose, where the game is stacked against you. And I know with Skyjohn's Battle and with the original version of it, which I played, it was definitely a very challenging game. You had, of course, the two actions per group for each turn. So only two characters could move. And the Blitzometer was set up that if you didn't kill an enemy within a certain number of turns, I believe the original advantage was that they get more movement. Was that how it was set up?
Yeah, and it was a very interesting blitz rule because we didn't want you dilly-dallying around on the battlefield. We found, and the thing is, like with the rule we had, we were trying to be more like chess and checkers as opposed to a true tactical RPG game where it was more like squad-based. We were trying to be, you bring in your crew and you kind of just defeat the enemy type of thing. And early in when we first released, you could bring in just two guys if you wanted to, or two units. You didn't have to bring all six back in the day. But when people brought six and they could only move, or they could only do two actions, they found a lot of times if they didn't look at the board correctly or watch what the enemy was going to do, they'd end up losing a lot of units. But that was I designed it to be kind of puzzle battles, if you will. Like get in the right spots, wait for the AI to do something. But they just did not go over very well. People just did not like their units dying when they couldn't stop it. But they didn't use the equalizers. They didn't use the weapons. So we learned a lot from players. Like, they just never clicked on the weapons. Why didn't they? You know, why didn't they use the equalizer, which were meant to kind of mitigate the fact he couldn't have more than two moves.
And I think I know an answer to that, because it's something that we've seen that phenomena with, like, even JRPG design, where players will hoard items and resources for the quote-unquote big situation. So they won't use, like, a healing item when they need it. They'll try to save it for, you know, the big boss fight, when they feel that, you know, now is the time. And it's a very interesting it's a very interesting player decision when that happens. Because as you're saying, you give the player all these options, whether it's equalizers or healing potions or whatever, and they just say, you know, I'm not going to use it. I'm going to wait until the final boss and then just throw everything at him. But it's definitely a problem with thinking in the short term and the long term in terms of, like, the player's response to some of these situations. And it can be very tricky, sometimes almost impossible, to wean them off of that strategy mindset.
Yep. And to add to that, the balance of how to have people still enjoy the game without just hoarding in our case, the power cells or whatever it was. They just found it to be like, they just basically what they called a grinding, just to get all the power cells, and then they, like you said, they would go to this big battle, and then they use a ton of them, right? But then wouldn't be another big battle for a while, but they still keep getting into other battles, and then they had no power cells. So then their units would die, right? So it's really interesting to balance that type of gameplay.
And another major part of that is the Iron Man or the permadeath side of things. I think that's another thing that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. I know you just said a few minutes ago, Jeff, that you equated the original combat system to, like, more like a fast-paced version of chess or like a puzzle action game where you're trying to figure out the best moves and then things are going to go very quickly. The problem with when you start adding in Iron Man elements, and what I think annoys a lot of people, is, as you're saying, they felt that they didn't have the control over their board or their units as you would in, say, a game like XCOM or a traditional roguelike. And when you start throwing in Iron Man elements into that, one battle can effectively screw your entire game. Like, if you lose your veteran rank characters due to either a unfortunate board setup or you didn't properly calculate where that guy was standing, if you lose your main damage deal and you can't get anyone else back to that level, that could effectively ruin your entire playthrough, or at least ruin the next, who knows, how many more matches after that.
Yeah, and that's what we found out happened. And I guess one of the things we learned was because we played it so much before we shipped it ourselves, we must have got expert syndrome or something where it's like, well, plus I wrote the AI, so I kind of knew I had an unfair advantage. But like that just never happened to me. And if it did, I just that was the game, right? I didn't get upset about it. I would just if I lost all my guys, I would do a new run, like you do in every other type of game like that. See how far you can get, and you learn stuff from each time you do it. You'll hopefully get a little more strategy, and you apply that next time. But we just found that people really just connected to the characters, and I think that goes back to some of the issues I was having with the design of the game too. Is I was trying to get to be more dozer centric instead of character centric because we had permadeath. I didn't want to have backstories for the characters. I didn't want to give them names because the minute you do that, people associate with them.
Of course, yeah, definitely. We've seen
Right.
that.
And we've seen that. So, which is, and I kind of lost that battle, and became more like a slight RPG, if you will, like because you cared about the characters all of a sudden, and they had names and backstories and these awesome portraits, and then they would die, and people were like, oh, well,
Yeah, that's another really interesting point, Evan. We've seen again that in so many games. I think XCOM being the long-standing example, even back in the original XCOM, where it was just nondescript men and women soldiers, like the same default model. People got attached to those. They gave them names, and we've seen that tradition carry on with the recent XCOM, where now you can do personalization options. And you're right about that, Jeff. That once people start connecting to their characters, it hurts a lot more to them when that character dies. We even see this in something like The Darkest Dungeon. And it's interesting that you said about having it be more dozer-centric as opposed to character-centric, because you playing the game, you do see that there are more, I guess, quote-unquote, RPG mechanics for the dozer than there are for the characters. You can find the different equalizers. You can upgrade when you're at least playing the campaign mode. You can upgrade the dozer in four different tracks using your power cells.
Yep. And that's how, like, when I was doing the original design early on, I was trying to have it just be, think of it like a Star Trek, right? Like the dozer was the ship essentially, and the crew was just supposed to be an away team, a nondescript grunts almost, if you will, which we still get flack for, which is why all the class members are identical. Like all the Deadeyes are the same. All the Trenchers are the same. So I never understood why, we ended up going down the route of giving them each names and stuff. But aside all that, but yeah, originally I wanted the dozer to be the machine that's the thing you upgrade. That's the thing you, with your stats and the characteristics and all that kind of thing for you in the world. And we were going to have, excuse me, like different routes that only certain dozers can go down. I asked the route I wanted to go down. But as we started going along, we found out we just didn't have enough time, the typical schedule type of thing. So we had to focus on one thing, and that was just the character battles and not the dozer stuff coming in.
And that can be very tricky, especially when you're trying to combine these multiple game systems together to create a single experience. Like the idea of having more of a focus on the dozer, having more, I guess, control and more decision making on that front would have expanded the metagame side of Skyshine's Bedlam and give players more to attach themselves to rather than just the tactical battles, which again, with the tactical battles being the forefront, everyone got attached to the characters. And then when they start losing them, it just creates that sliding slope down that they just get frustrated, and then chances are they're just not going to finish the game, or worse, they're not going to come back to the game, which is not what you want in any roguelike situation.
Yeah, and that's the part that I learned a lot because, admittedly, I didn't play a whole lot of roguelikes before this one, before we started underway, and like I didn't understand, I guess, people's affliction to having characters die, even though it's a roguelike. So I guess in that case, which is why we started doing this whole redux, is kind of trying to take some of that out of it, and kind of bring it back to not RPG because we're not an RPG by any means. Even though they keep trying to put that in there, we're not a true RPG. We don't have stats on each. We do it, but we don't have, 17 different stats that you have to kind of build up and grow with your character and whatnot. But because of that, those issues. So we try to bring more of those into the Redux to help satisfy that we're not really dozer centric anymore, and put more of the emphasis on battles.
Yeah. And there's one point I want to go back to what you said a few minutes ago regarding early access, but another, since we're still talking, I guess, the preliminary design stuff right now, slash on Spellum, one other question that I want to ask you about, Jeff, was the decision to have the last hitting mechanics as the main form of character progression, as opposed to in like games like XCOM or the roguelikes where the battle ends and like the group gets a percentage of the experience, or anyone who attacks enemy gets like partial experience or something along those lines.
Yeah, so because my background in video games is always arcade, over the top games, I was trying to keep that into this as well, which is why it's not really RPG. It's like I call it more of a light RPG. So each character itself, like when they do well in battle, of course they better up or they level up, and they change their costume. It was kind of rewarding. We got a cool sound effect. Kind of like the old 80s style arcades where you just eat a power up and you grow a little bit bigger type of thing. Instead of having all these numbers that you have to go back and tweak to adjust, because it's, and we didn't have enough time to balance a game like that with our tight schedule anyway. So we kind of had to keep it more arcade-like, which, you know, which is why the battlefields were smaller. There was less kind of tactic, if you will, that term, or how to plan around and like around on the battlefield. And there's no, kind of like when you look at other games, you got it's like you have to traverse the island. There's no, you know, line of, like, what do you call that? Fog of war, none of that kind of stuff.
And I guess like having that arcade background, especially with the, you can see a lot of that with Sky Shines Bellum. Again, we can talk about the Blitzomir, we can talk about the original two actions per team design. And the game was meant to be that fast paced. I'm sure if we had the time, we could sit for like the next 2-3 hours and talk a whole lot more about these design decisions, because it is very fascinating. It's not something we hear from a lot of developers, especially talking about at this critical level. And that also goes back to what you were saying a few minutes ago regarding the early access and deciding not to do it, because that's another very interesting tool we're seeing developers can make use of these days. Like it's a good example of that. A few of my previous podcast guests, I can't believe I forget his name now. Tim Keenan from Misfits Attic, who's working on the roguelike-ish game Duskers. We talked about how early access did a lot to help improve the game. But there's also that risk of showing too much of the game, or the fact that certain games may not have worked. Now, I guess my question for you, Jeff, is did you guys at all, while you were after the Kickstarter for Bedlam, did you consider doing any early access for the game, or did that just not come up?
We talked about it, but we were so far along with the game at the point where you'd want to do an early access, we wouldn't have changed it based on the feedback, because we actually had a game we thought we actually liked and had fun playing. And then we couldn't spend 3 months, for example, which is a typical early access time, and let the game be played by other people and give out too much, or not, or not show everything, or whatever, however, different games do it different ways. But we just didn't want to preview the game and then not be able to change it if they did suggest something. So we were kind of like, well, we could, if something goes really wrong, we could maybe patch it, which is maybe the wrong theory. Who knows? I've seen games do it both ways.
Yeah, that balance between showing too much or showing too little is always very difficult for a designer to do, to decide upon, especially when you're thinking about that early access. And that's what I talked about when I talked to the developer from Molasses Flood who did Flame in the Flood. He said that he wasn't a fan of early access for that reason. He didn't want to show the game off in those kinds of states. He wants to show it, or he wanted to show it at the game's absolute best.
Right, right. And I mean, I you know, back in the day in the arcade, there was no such thing as early access. Like, you finished it, you kind of put it out in the arcade and see how well it did. But yeah, we didn't want to have people play a game that wasn't done. It would be hard to filter out any review or feedback based on what is it because the game's not complete, or is it because of the actual game rule? And we honestly just didn't actually have the time or the manpower to do it.
And that's the other side of things. The amount, you know, how much money or how much time and energy has been spent working on that game. It's a lot different when you're working on a game that's still in, you know, alpha version 0.005 versus something that's 90-95% of the way done, that, you know, the whole game engine's finished, the foundation is set. So if someone, like, let's say you did put it in early access, someone said, I don't like this combat system, can you change it? It's just not feasible, it's not just economically viable if the game's, you know, a month or two away from release. You can't just go back and tear apart your whole engine and rebuild it from scratch.
Right. And that's what we were afraid of. I mean, we weren't really afraid. I mean, in a word, we kind of were, but we actually thought we had a fun game when we were ready to go to launch. So, plus with all the positive feedback from the reviews and trade, we thought we had a winner, so to speak.
Yeah. And that's another one of those topics we could spend who knows how long talking about, like, why the game just did not mesh with consumer perception. And that definitely gives me an idea for another post to write about, because I'm also quite confused about the level that the game just didn't work in terms of the consumer mindset. And it's one of those, again, goes back to what I was saying about 5 or 6 minutes ago, the push and pull of roguelike mechanics has really become very tricky to balance. If you make it too easy, then you have people complaining, you know, it's a roguelike, but there's no threat on board. You make it too hard, and people will just bounce right off of it.
Yep. And which is why we put difficulty levels in there, you know, easy, medium, and hard. But that still didn't help the situation with the reviews that came in as far as the brutalness of the game, and which clearly, frankly, I didn't see until we changed the game in Redux. Then I went back and played the old version, and then I understood what people were talking about. But because they were coming from a game that had that tactical type of movement where you had two actions per player, with the expectation that it was going to be like that in our game. And then I understood how they always died. I kept dying too then after I played our game with the new game mechanic. So now I understand. Now if I go back in time, I would know what they're talking about.
Yeah. And I would say one last design point that I want to talk about before we talk more about the Redux side and the post-release has to do with the idea of that negative feedback loop or that downward slope. That's, I think, another thing that really annoys a lot of people when one battle or one decision kind of just sets everyone up for failure. We see this with a lot of roguelikes where an incorrect use of a resource or taking too much damage in one part will weaken the character and will make it hard for subsequent battles, and then it just goes down and down and down until things mess up. And I think that's another part that sort of hurt the original Skyshine's Bedlam. Because of the Iron Man rules, you lose, if you get a complete party wipe on a battle, you lose all your veterans. Chances are you're not going to come back from that, no matter how many more battles you have, because of the fact that the difficulty level continues to go up. In a game like XCOM, where you are expected to lose these characters, you can always get more characters as long as you have the funding. Even with the latest XCOMs, where you have the RPG side of things, losing a character, you still have some means to recoup that. But when I was playing the original with Skyshine's Bedlam, like, if you lose your veterans, who, because of there not being a lot of RPG mechanics, you know, a veteran is just better than a regular character. There's no discussion about that. You lose that character, you really just take a hit to the knee that some players may not be able to recover from.
Yeah, and that did happen. And we didn't, like, when we were playing it ourselves, that happened and we lost the game. I'm like, oh, okay. I got a bad roll that time, or I made a bad couple bad decisions. But now that I see, we can talk about it in a minute, but now that I see how we changed it to going back to playing it before, I can understand the frustration.
Yeah.
And we just didn't account, we didn't recognize that before we launched, because that was the game we designed. So we didn't see the flaw.
Yeah. And this next question, I'm not sure how you'll be able to answer this, but because we've talked about early access, and since I have been focusing a lot more with early access discussions with previous podcast guests, I just have to ask you, Jeff, if you decide to work on a future game, you know, whatever genre, whatever, and it's going to be a PC release, do you think you will try early access in the future, or do you prefer to keep it more in the traditional line of development?
Yeah, that's a tough call, because I read a lot of articles, like the one about Darkest Dungeon and what happened to them when they went to early access, and then I've seen games that succeeded from it. So if there's a way I could do it where you don't give a whole lot away, but you kind of show the core of the game, so they can just try that out. Maybe just like if I was going to do another battle game, for example, I would set up a kind of an arena or something that uses the kind of mechanic, but it wouldn't be the full game.
Yeah.
So they can kind of just test those areas out and give feedback for it.
I know that's similar to what they did with the Banner Saga, that they released just like the multiplayer PvP combat system, and then they kept all the story, all that progression completely, you know, squared away. They didn't do anything with that until the game was released, and then they gave that side to the players. Well, they just use the PvP simply, as you were just saying, Jeff, for the combat testing, to test out the mechanics, to test out character balance, stuff like that.
Yeah, and then, you know, so they called it factions. And we were going to do the same type of thing. But again, it really came down to time and money for us. We just didn't have the resources to do all that kind of like, you know, do a faction version and just wait around while we work on this massive story.
Yeah.
Because of our, you know, the funds are limited, the time was limited.
Yeah.
So we kind of had to go with our original design and just try it.
Yeah, and unfortunately, that's one of the murkier sides of game development. It can be a gamble. No matter how much you play test, no matter how much you enjoy your game, you just never know until you put it in the hands of the consumer and get their official seal of approval or their thumbs down.
Yep, and like, you know, we tried focus groups in the past, and like, none of those are just good indicators until it goes live.
Exactly.
And unfortunately, once it goes live, it's almost too late.
Yep. And
especially on Steam.
Oh, yes. Because
once you get those reviews flying in, I mean, I read a lot of people sending me feedback saying, well, I put your game on my wish list, you know, because of the negative reviews and stuff, or your mixed review set, or whatever it was. I'll wait till it goes on sale or something.
Yeah, exactly. And especially with Steam these days, the rate that games are coming out, you don't have like 3 to 5 months after release to hopefully gauge how it's going to do, how it fares on the market. You have pretty much a few days. If your game gets hit with negative reviews right out the gate, it just, again, we can talk about that negative feedback loop. The negative reviews push it down, so it becomes harder for people to find. And they do find, they're going to see those mixed reviews, or it's going to say negative, and that's enough for someone who's just like looking for a game to say, I don't want to play that game, it's got negative reviews. And that discoverability is such a major issue, especially for indie developers these days.
Yeah, and that's like you asked me what I would do differently next time. I don't know if I would definitely put somehow make a demo available or something like that, so that you don't have to pay money. I know that Steam just did this like refund thing, which I still don't like. But like, it'd be cool to have a demo of the game or something like that that they can play and just make their own judgment, even regardless of the review. But you're right, the review does significantly, I think, impact people's decision to buy, especially if the price is high or low, or like those kind of things on Steam, at least.
Yeah. And again, we could easily spend 2-3 hours just talking more about this, and I would love to, but I'm sure you've already thought about this long and hard over the last 6 months. So, let's talk more about the post-release and the Redux, because this is the part I'm sure a lot of developers are especially curious about, because it's not something, again, that we see every day. The only other game I can think of that went with such a vigorous post-release launch was Planetary Annihilation by Uber Entertainment, which, incidentally, they were another Kickstarter game. And what's interesting is, as you were saying, Jeff, about, you know, the pros and cons of early access, they did do early access. And they were one of the few examples where the early access didn't do it didn't impact the game's release. When it did come out, it was hit with a lot of negative reviews as well. A lot of people saying that the game wasn't finished, wasn't what they expected, etc., etc. And they pretty much spent the entire year after release trying to get the game to a point that the consumers were going to be happy. They, you know, rewrote the AI. They added new features. They redid the UI. They added in the new features. They redid the UI. And they just did a lot of performance tweaks to it. And instead of going, like, as you did, Jeff, with just re-releasing the game under a new title, they just said, you know what, we're just going to release Planetary Annihilation Titans. This is, you know, the pseudo-sequel with all those fixes in it. And I think it's helped them a little bit. But again, as we were just saying a few minutes ago, if you get those negative reviews out of the gate, they can just be like weights, you know, pulling you down. So, for you then, and this is where we're talking more about the Redux side of things, after the game, after Skullgirls Bedlam was released, and you start to look at it and look at the consumer's reaction, how did you decide to, I guess, take that and start thinking, how are we going to fix or improve Bedlam?
Yeah, so where do I start? So when we shipped in September, we all took, the three of us took a little time off. I didn't really see the negative reviews for about 2 weeks, probably, let's say. And then I started looking at them like, wow, they're kind of negative. And then I started reading them, and they're all like, I hate this mechanic. I hate, like, you know, whatever it was, too hard. Mm-hmm. And so we just, like I said earlier, we kind of mitigated that with 2.0 and 2.4. Fixed a few of the complaints people had, put another difficulty level in, but that didn't help, like I said earlier. And then, so now we're in like November timeframe. And I think we were just really shocked and dismayed by the reviews and that people were attacking us. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, they were just calling me the worst programmer in the world. Like, they were calling the animations, you know, high school. Like, it was just rude. Mm-hmm. And it was just deflammatory. And like, it was just, we lost our willing to do anything. Like, we just quit. Just about in December, like we didn't touch the game. We're like, wow, there's nothing, you know, we can do. And after the break, after Christmas and all that kind of thing, I couldn't let it die like that. I couldn't let this game that we spent a year and some months on just vanish into another one like with those kind of reviews. Mm-hmm. So I set out as a personal mission of my own, because the other two guys, at first they didn't help. You know, the main artist already went to work for another company. And then the animator, he was kind of just, you know, he was trying to catch back up as far as how the game did and how negatively it was reviewed. It really affected him. Mm-hmm. So he was out for a while. He just, you know, go take a sabbatical or whatever he was doing. So it was basically just me for a few months, just sitting here on my computer, just trying to, how can I make the game better? And I read all the reviews again, and then I compiled all the notes and like, wow, okay, I could easily do these kind of things because most of them are like just coding, mm-hmm. right? There's no new art required. So I could fix a lot of this stuff just by going back and kind of redesigning how we did things with the characters and the script, the launch screen and the battles and the AI and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I spent like 2.5 months, almost 3 months just doing that before any of the other artists came back in to help out. So then I had a new game or a new version of the game that I let them play, and they were loving it. Like, oh, because this new version is what we end up calling Redux. And once they started playing it with the 2 AP per play, you know, player mechanic and the new on screen where you can pick your configuration of characters and the ability to play at any race you want to. And I added all those features in there and then, you know, made the threat level adjustable via events. And I went back to all the events and kind of made some of them random. Just any complaint I found, I tried to address all in code. Mm-hmm. And then once I had that point where the game was playable again with all the new rules, then the animator, he got really back into it and he started creating all the new faction characters and added some more elites. And then basically we spent a good another month just testing it, making sure as best we could. We couldn't afford any money to hire any QA anymore. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, because at this point we're working out of our pockets type of thing because all the money had ran out, mm-hmm. Which is why it was hard to do. So I had to spend 4 months of my own time just for the love of the game. and it turned out to be a really, really fun version of the game. And then we talked to our publisher, Versus Evil, to try to get behind it as well, and they did. And then we got lucky, and we finished it right around South by Southwest here in Austin, and we were able to get a booth and show off the game there. And so things are just starting, like, once we hit, and then we kind of did the whole Steam launch that same day, the relaunch of the game. And if you look at the reviews now we're 65 or 66% from down up from like 48 percent. So I think the consensus is we did the right thing. It took a long time. But,
yeah, and that's one thing I really want to ask you, Jeff. I don't know if this is, if you can answer this or maybe too soon to tell, but have things improved since the Redux upgrade in terms of sales or overall impressions of the game?
The impressions completely have turned around 180. Like, I could read some reviews of guys who, I mean, dogged the game so bad. And then I went and actually, even though Steam says they shouldn't do this, I did it anyway. I went and talked to every guy, person, player who gave us a negative review and told them about the new Redux update. And if you get a chance, try it again. Cause it, you know, I spent the last, like, kind of like the story I just gave you. I crafted this little message and sent it to them. And, you know, we got 50 feedback. We got people, 50 people who answered us and said, holy crap, this is the best thing since sliced bread. You guys can't, I can't believe you guys changed the game. And they some people started changing negative reviews to positive. And there has been an uptick in sales. How much, I don't know yet. But, you know, because we were kind of like, heading downward, you know, very slowly, kind of ambling about. And then Redux happened. And so we're now in a nice little uptick. And I just found out we're going to be showed at or included with our publisher at PAX East. So people can demo and play the new version there as well.
And again, it sounds like things have been turning around. And I do want to ask you, Jeff, about, as you were saying, with the Redux upgrade and the time you spent, that you did look over all the negative reviews, you look at the community. One of the challenges of it being a game designer is trying to, again, separate the signal from the noise. So as you were looking at your version of Sky Shines Bedlam, looking at what people were saying, how did you, I guess, pick and choose what to really change? Like, how were you able to separate the signal from the noise, from the consumer impressions?
I mean, I've been working in games for a long time, and I've played a lot of games, too. So when I read the reviews, after you know some time off, I started understanding their frustrations. Or so I came back to our game again with a fresh perspective and played our game again after not having played for about a month. And then I started seeing some of the things that people were talking about in the game. And then I took to all those, like I said, I read all the reviews and kind of looked at them. And then I looked at what I could do in any kind of decent time frame. Like, I'm not going to change the entire game to be, you know, XCOM, right? I'm not going to add in Fog of War and 3D environments, like some people said. Like, there's a lot of, you know, I mean, I still had to stay within the confines of our game design. Because I didn't want to go back and rewrite the whole game. So I was trying to find, is there something like, okay, you know, so basically I took their ideas and I go, how do I make that into our game? Like, if they suggested Overwatch or something like that, or whatever it was, a different rule from a different game, I go, well, can I make that an equalizer in our game? Or so I try to bring it into our game, and if it would benefit, I would add it. And of course, one of the big things, of course, was 2 AP per player. And then people are suggesting about battle boards, and so I made those some of those bigger, and you know, things like that. That I just kind of, as long as they fit in my game design or in the game design itself, I added, I put on the list, and I got to it and developed it.
And I mean, as a good example of that, you were watching me play, or you watch one of my recordings of Sky Shines Bellum after the Redux upgrade, and I suggested about showing movement radius, I'm sorry, showing attack radiuses when you're looking at the enemy's movement field. And he just said, I'm going to include that in the next patch.
And I mean, it makes a lot of sense because, and you know, like when we played, we thought, well, but one of our problems was we had a left click for attack. And what happened to a lot of people was that they would want to go look at the enemy by left-clicking on them, but sometimes you get attacked. Like, you know, your character will attack them. So we changed the mechanic now. You can still go back to the old way, but now you can use right click as all the actions. Mm-hmm. So now you're free to left click on anybody. And when I did that, then I was able to do what you suggested, which is if you click on an enemy, then if you move around in his movement zone, mm-hmm. you can see where he would attack, just like one of your units.
Yeah. And I think you made a really good point a few seconds ago, Jeff, regarding, again, trying to keep these suggestions within the confines of the game. Like, as we were saying in the first part of this cast, you can't just, you know, completely tear apart your engine and say, let's make the game 3D now. Let's add in Fog of War. That stuff doesn't work. And a lot of the improvements to Skyshine's Bedlam through the Redux upgrade were under the hood. Again, changing a lot of the underlying mechanics. As you were saying, adding more of the tactical side to the game rather than the arcade. So players are spending a lot more time during the combat, but it's a lot more time under their control. As a good example, of course, would be the two actions now per unit, the movement field, the attack field looking, and stuff like that. I would say one thing that I really liked was the fact that you can now have the different factions as crew members, and what you were doing, at least at the time when I played Redux, you had like the different like powers or the different passives for each faction. So like the cyborgs, every three turns they get a one turn that they are cloaked, or I think at the time of this recording you're adding in like humans get additional movement like for like one turn, like every three turns.
Yeah, every faction has an ability that's innate in that faction. Mm-hmm. And I just added in the last update, humans now have the every other turn they get plus one movement mm-hmm. During battle only. Like once you get out of battle, it resets that. Mm-hmm. I've had a lot of people say the AI one is too powerful, for example, where they go invisible. Mm-hmm. So I'm changing that now.
Yeah.
In the next update, which I can talk about in a minute, because the next update is all battle centric. That's all I'm doing.
Yeah.
People have been saying, hey, you should make battles even more strategic. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, okay.
And again, it's kind of weird to talk about that, because as we were saying at the start of this cast, with the original intent of Skyshine's Bedlam, it was going to be very arcade-like, very much dozer-focused. So the metagame was going to have a lot more pronouncement. Combo was supposed to be, you know, quick and dirty, get through it, get back to the dozer, get back to that kind of metagame. And now we've seen the game transition into more of, again, an emphasis on the tactical layer, on controlling these units, keeping them alive, while the meta has been, downplayed, but sort of been relegated to more of a second place in terms of player choice and player decision making.
Yep. And I think people like that. Mm-hmm. With the game, that wasn't our original design, but mm-hmm. you know what? You try something, it doesn't work. You try something else, and that's what we kind of did with this one. Mm-hmm. And I think now we're at a point where the game is like I have fun playing it again,
yeah.
like I did originally. But now the design has kind of shifted to the more crew centric mm-hmm. Strategy side of it. Now I can see a lot of places where I can add more strategy type of things.
Yeah,
which is why when I'm very active in the Steam community, like I'm always talking to everybody in there. Anybody I can mm-hmm. to get their ideas, because I mean, you know, just ideas are free, mm-hmm. and you know, some of them aren't free to develop, of course. But I take anything. I might, you know, like one guy suggested something to do with cover, and it was like, oh yeah, well that's real easy. Why didn't we think of that? Things like that, where it's just, oh, okay.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, Jeff. And that's a really That's not only just a really good point. That's something that is a huge thing for especially game developers, for anyone. You just never know when you're so invested in a product, you do develop blind spots. As you were saying earlier in this cast, you didn't have any problems with the design because obviously you're the one who built it. It's hard for the person who built it to find any problems or to be able to look at things from the outside. That's been like one of the major points of, you know, focus groups, early access, etc., etc. And sometimes when you have people from the outside looking in, they can see stuff or they can find things that you may never have would have found or would have thought about. I mean, I'll give you a good example of that right here at Game Wisdom. By the time this cast goes up, I sat down with a developer, and in like the first 5 minutes of talking, he suggested a tagline for the site that it's so simple and brilliant that I have never thought of that in the last 3+ years of doing this. And it just fits the site perfectly. But again, I'm so invested in the site, I never would have thought of that. And the same thing with game developers. Like when I spoke with Tim Keenan from Misfits, he talked the same exact thing that you just said, Jeff, about how the community suggested things. Now, of course, some of it's impossible. Like, you're not going to rebuild the game exactly, but they may suggest something that it sounds so innocuous that it works, but you may never would have thought of that on your own since you're completely invested looking at the entire game's design and mechanics.
Yeah, and like one of the biggest complaints I still get, and I don't understand the complaint. I mean, I know what the complaint is, but they don't like the fact, like, for example, our Deadeye has what I call a dead zone, right? And he can only shoot 5 tiles away. Like, so if you get inside of him, he can't shoot. He has to back off to attack.
Yeah.
And that was the point of, like, when I kept going back to, we're a chess type of game. Each piece has a certain movement and attacks on, like a knight in chess. And if you bring another unit in, they fill in those gaps, like the trencher and the gunslingers fill in those holes. But what happens is, and I really didn't see this playing it, but what happens is people play and they try to do a run through and they end up losing all their gunslingers or something, and they're left just with trenchers and dead eyes. That's a lot harder to fill that hole that they have there. Right, so then they lose more battles because they can't stop the AI.
Exactly.
But that's what we kept trying to say. Well, that's where you're supposed to use your equalizers and your weapons.
And again, goes back to what I was saying earlier with that hoarding mentality of resources, which then just leads to that negative feedback loop. And again, as you were just saying, if you run out of trenchers or gunslingers, or anyone who can deal with close range, and you're just left with the dead eyes. I do like the idea that you can sort of get in, like get past their offense. But again, if you're left with just them, and you're fighting 3 or 4 guys who just blindside them, rush them in, there's literally no way for them to attack. And then, of course, what's going to happen? They're going to get killed. You lose more guys and stuff like that. Now, that actually takes me to a really interesting question I have for you, Jeff. I should have asked this, I think, earlier in the design part, but considering that negative feedback loop and how critical it is for units to survive and what happens when you lose them, have you ever considered allowing players to essentially, I guess, quote-unquote, buy characters to, like, fit those classes? Like, let's say I run out of trenchers. Let me spend X amount of resources and I can hire a new trencher or something like that.
Yeah, and so this is actually a good segue into my next update, which is all battle-focused. I'm currently working on right now, and a few of the big changes I'm doing are, for example, our equalizers will only affect the selected crew instead of the entire crew to bring more strategy. Because like before, I was watching a lot of people play the game, and they're like, oh, I just turn on my invisibility, and I win the battle type of thing. That can't happen no more. So now there's a lot more strategy about who you give the invisibility to. So just by doing that one simple change, the strategy in battles now is like tenfold. I'm also adding in, I'm changing the AI's ability from invisibility to teleport.
Okay.
There's a big change now that people have been requesting for a long time, is you can now choose what happens to a unit when they level up. So in, like right now in the game, today as you play it, if you get 3 kills, he turns into a veteran. The veteran's automatically just a better character. And then if you kill with that veteran, if you get 3 more kills, he levels up. And all it ever did was just add 1 to damage. And I think there's like 3 level maxes. So what I'm doing now, and it's actually really fun, I just basically, when you turn to veteran now, you get full health, but that's it. You don't get any, you don't get more damage right away or nothing. And then if you survive battle, you go back to the crew page. And then you can put that, I want to call it point, I guess, whatever you want to call it, into either movement, damage, or health. So you can kind of decide how that character grows. So for example, I was, for my Deadeye, of course, I gave him more movement. I want him to be able to move 3 or 4 instead of just 3 so that he could get out of the way in the case of he's fighting a trench or something and get off and attack. Mm-hmm. That's another huge change. Yeah. It's going to take us about a week to, you know, I mean, it's already in there. I've already have a playable version of it. Mm-hmm. But now to like balance that, make sure that.
Of course, definitely.
Right.
Oh, yeah. That's always one of the challenges, especially when you start altering and tweaking these mechanics. Little changes can mean big deals. Even just changing one character's attack from, let's say, 5 to 4 or 5 to 6 can be huge for balance and design. I guess, as we're segueing into talking more about the future of Scottish Lines Bedlam and what's coming, as an important part of that, as you're tweaking the combat mechanics for the player side, how are things going to be changed, or if they're going to be changed, in terms of the AI, or, you know, the number of enemies, or how they respond on the field?
Let me answer your last question first. Mm-hmm. We are looking into, or I'm looking into, I should say, ways of recruiting new crew. Mm-hmm. Whether it be like on the crew page or not, you have to spend so many power cells to get a new crew member or something, or maybe instead of power cells, maybe it's meat or something. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But the problem is like every time we do that, then people don't seem to have enough power cells to fire off a weapon.
Yeah.
Right. So it's really hard to charge power cells for something because it's such a critical resource in the game. So we're still trying to figure out how to actually do that part of it. Like, does that mean we got to give you more resources in battle? Once you start doing that, you can make the game too easy.
Yeah, definitely.
It's really hard to balance that, which is why it's... We change, like you said, we add 10 more power cells here, but that might be the whole way people win the game. Mm-hmm. You just never know. And I've heard stories like, oh, this game is really easy. I just get 150 power cells, and I'm like, what? And I play, and I've had a few runs where you can get that many based on luck.
Exactly.
You know, what POIs you get. So, yeah, we are looking at that as well. And as far as the AI goes, mm-hmm. There's only so much I could do without trying to turn it into a
completely different game, essentially.
Right, tactical like espionage game or something, because our battle boards are fairly simple. Mm-hmm. The one thing I am looking into is having turrets, or like what you want to call it, towers of some sort, kind of like devices that are always on Overwatch. Mm-hmm. So instead of putting your character in Overwatch, there's these new battlefield things that are like either in the middle of the battlefield or on the sides that if you get into its range, it's going to shoot you. Mm-hmm. So that adds like strategy to where you can go on the battlefield and things like that. Mm-hmm. I'm also looking into giving the AI the ability to fire off equalizers.
That sounds very interesting there.
Yeah, to make it more fair, right? Because the problem is like AI can't do anything. Mm-hmm. All it can do is throw more guys at you.
Yeah.
Which if you have a nuclear weapon or a weapon, that doesn't do much. Mm-hmm. I mean, so I had to make them, like, for example, the AI guys get stronger as the threat level goes up, mm-hmm. right? Because they don't have, like, the AI doesn't have veterans.
Yeah.
Or hardly, and the only time you see elites is, like, when you fight the kings or elite battles. But normal battles are always just kind of rookies, almost. Mm-hmm. So now I'm looking at ways, how do I let the AI throw off an equalizer?
Mm. And
so I'm still experimenting with that. Mm-hmm.
And again, that goes back to the trying to figure out that balance with the power cells. And I can give you a little bit of impressions from my end. I think what people are having trouble with is the fact that the power cells are used for so much in the game as it is. You need them for the equalizers. You need them to upgrade the dozer if you're playing on campaign mode. So because it has all these functionality to it, and the fact that the only way or the easiest way you're going to get it is by getting them, you know, the random drops during battle, that it tends to make them more of a precious commodity, so people hoard them more. But as you're saying, Jeff, if you increase the amount of power cells or the amount of energy cells, guess what? Now they'll be able to use more equalizers, which any battle in the game right now, you have, you know, 200, 300 or power cells, guess what? You can just throw equalizer after equalizer. There's no challenge, basically. They'll nuke the crap out of everything on the field.
Yep.
And again, if you don't give them enough, then as you were saying, because of the importance of equalizers as a way to counter when you're fighting, you know, 5 or 6 man enemy groups, if they don't have that option, they're not going to be able to go toe-to-toe with these battles, and then they're going to lose, and then that negative feedback loop just starts all over again.
Right. So that, I mean, yeah, you just explained the conundrum I'm in.
Yeah.
It's very hard to balance that and still make it fun. Or and if you make it too easy, nobody has fun. And you know, the thing is like that because the game is sort of random,
You never know.
it's even harder to balance because the events give out, you know, if you just happen to get four power cell events in a row,
Of course. Yeah.
I mean, which I could write all this code to stop that from happening. But then, you know, then how do you justify that? How do you balance that even? It's just, so it was really no way other than just kind of mitigate how battles were fought in the first place. Like you can only fire a weapon once in battle. Things like that were the only true way to kind of make it a little more fair, at least for the AI, because they don't get to launch missiles at you, right? They don't have any equalizers other than what the faction could do. Like they didn't have any of these powers. So they just have four guys out there who get slaughtered all the time until they get hefty enough with enough hit points as the threat level goes up higher. Then this becomes a challenge, right? Because you can't just shoot them once or nuke them once and they don't die.
Yeah, they're just gonna keep coming. Like in the game that I played, when I ran to like the elite with like 43 or 53 points of health, you can't just hit him with a nuke one turn and be done with it. You gotta focus that guy down. He's gonna rush you and kick your ass.
Yeah, which is why like the Viserra battles are, you know, the guy, the King Viserra has like 60 hit
Oh
points and things like that.
yeah, that was a shocker when I ran to that on the.
The people were walking into that battle with 200 power cells or something. It's like if you don't do that, then they're like, oh, that was it? That was the main battle?
It's and again, but if they came to that battle with, let's say, five power cells and they only had their four units, it's like, how the hell am I supposed to beat this guy if I'm doing like five or six per unit and he can just, wipe me out in one or two hits?
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that is the ultimately the idea, like on the map, is you know he's there, and you know, in my mind, you're supposed to prepare for that battle, right? If you go to that battle unprepared, of course, you shouldn't expect to win, in my mind. I mean, I've seen people win still,
But
because they brought in like overpowered elites and whatnot, right, of their own. But for the most part, yeah, if you walk in with 10 power cells into a battle like that, you're a goner. And your only hope is if you're playing arcade mode, you can go pick up the other two power cells type of thing and get enough to launch one weapon or something. But yeah, it's a tough battle. And I don't know how to make that. I don't want to make it easier because then there's no challenge.
Yeah, if you make that battle or you make it easier to do something along that line, that's going to infer on all the other battles. And
Yeah,
again,
exactly.
the feedback loop just changes. Now, one suggestion that I have, I'm not sure if you thought about this, what about making some equalizers use different resources? So, like, let's say one of them could maybe use five meat instead of 10 power cells, or just a way to take the load off of making the power cells such a requirement or such a hoarding commodity for the player.
That's actually a great suggestion. One that was brought up a long time ago when we first designed the game, to have crewed, our three resources would control three slots. Our original design of the game, it'd be funny if I had a picture of it, it's so different. But the weapons were based on the crewed and the meat and the power cells. But yeah, like if we were to do that now, it would become a like you could easily I could that code would like take 10 minutes to write. It would come down to how like balancing that again. Like now does meat all of a sudden get used too often
Of
and
course, yeah.
your crew starts dying. But yeah, I was trying to figure out a way, and now that you brought it up again, I wrote it down already again just so I don't forget it this time. This might be the way to get everybody's mind off of power cells all the time and quit thinking that crewed and meat are useless, and you don't have to worry about them. But because you actually do have to, but not like you said earlier, they kind of been mitigated down. But a way to make them important again is that like that's how you fire your weapons or something. You got to use your crewed, for example, to fire weapons and not power cells, right?
Or maybe even have like alternatives. Like, let's say an equalizer could use 10 power cells or 15 crude or 18Me or something along that line. Again, just some way to spread the purposes around your resources rather than focusing on one thing, because as we were just saying, power cells do a lot in the game. They fire the equalizers. They allow you to upgrade your dozer in those four categories if you're playing campaign. So, and again, if you run out of power cells, you essentially lose the tactical side of the game, which will then mean you're going to lose the meta side of the game. And that kind of push and pull between meta and tactical layer, one, it's a great thing that makes a lot of the most amazing games, but it's also one of the hardest things to balance, as you can obviously attest to now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've actually wrote that down because I'm going to look into that later today. Mm-hmm. How we would use, because part of it, I don't want to make them have to choose in battle mm-hmm. which resource they use. Right, because they got to bring up another menu.
Yeah,
then
that
gotta,
would be another design. That would be another UI you have to design, that
right.
kind of thing.
I don't want to make it that complex. Mm-hmm. So the things, you could maybe make it like where certain equalizers have to use meat. Like I think you suggested that first, where, it maybe the health equalizer doesn't use power cells, it uses meat. Mm-hmm. Right, you got to eat. To eat healthy food. I don't know, but like, or eat an apple like you do in a lot of games, right? Yeah. or drink like, so you could like convict, like that equalizer could be meat based.
Yeah.
Instead of power cell based. And you could do a couple of them like that, where you could use crude for one of them. Mm-hmm. And you're right. I think that's a great way of getting all the emphasis off of power cells. And that kind of thing is easy to put in the game and just, yeah. we can play test it. And, actually good segue to that. So what I have learned from the whole Steam thing mm-hmm. is I now put up branches in Steam.
Yeah.
And allow players via password, the ones that are most vocal and willing to play the game before I put it out in Steam. So they can give me feedback based on what I've changed. So like what I want to do next week, for example, is I want to put up version 3.08 up in the beta branch or whatever, and let people test it for a little bit mm-hmm. and give me their feedback on, oh yeah, this is really awesome. No, this is too hard now. Or I can still win. Because the players who beat the game, they're the ones who notice the most when I change it. Because mm-hmm. they're like, oh yeah, I can totally see the different tactics here. Oh, the AI is way smarter here, or it is harder now. People who haven't played it before, they're not going to notice the change. They're going to notice that the game is just better.
Yeah.
In general. I want to do that with all these changes. And now that you brought that up, I'm totally gonna go ahead now. Have an equalizer be meat and crude based. Mm-hmm. I think that's brilliant.
Oh, thank you.
And I figured out how to get rid of the power cells, and that's one way of doing it.
Yeah. And as you were saying a few minutes ago, with being able to enhance the tackle side and then sort of take that and build upon the meta or strategy layer. I know in the first part you were talking about how the game was more dozer focused with different paths, different options there. Are there any plans now to start changing or improving or upgrading the meta side or the strategy side of Skyshine's Bedlam?
Not really, mm-hmm. just because it's...
Yeah.
The problem with that change and that kind of stuff is people who've already been playing it, mm-hmm. Like we've already seen the problem already with campaign, for example. Mm-hmm. Once, if they complete the first leg of the campaign, for example, the relics are no longer there. Mm-hmm. People are like, why aren't the relics there? You say, the relics are supposed to be there. Well, you've already did the first leg in a previous version of the game. Mm-hmm. Right? We don't go back and undo your progress for you. Mm-hmm. Because that would be even worse.
Yeah.
So it's hard to redesign that aspect of it when there's so many players out there now in the middle of their games.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's part of the reason why I haven't touched the whole map side of things. Mm-hmm. The battles one, because battles are always new and unique every time you go to one. Mm-hmm. It's easy to modify because it doesn't affect their progress per se.
Yeah.
Whereas changing, how many crew it takes to get to a certain road, or now that the distiller can't go down this road no more, they might get stuck on the map or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we're leaving that out until the next sequel, or if there's one, we're put all that logic into the next version.
Mm-hmm. All right.
with a bigger world and things like that.
Yeah, and this has been a very great cast, Jeff. I think it's a good thing to hear how much things have turned around for Skylines Battle with the examples you've mentioned, with a lot of people rewriting their negative reviews. I know, I think I took mine down too at the time. And it is really great to hear how much things have improved. I mean, just from when I did the stream and play like a few, like an hour or so of the Redux upgrade, it felt a lot better. And the changes that we've talked about tonight, what you're planning on adding with more of the battle side of things, I think it's going to do a lot more to improve Skylines Bedlam.
I agree, which is why I can't let this title die. I don't know what it is in me, but I have this drive to make this game. Because I see the potential there, and I really do. And I can't give up on it, regardless of what, time-wise or whatever. I have to do this, and I have to do it for myself. And I hope the players enjoy it. I literally feel like it, almost like I'm powered by them now, if you will.
Yeah.
now that they kind of go on and turn things around and uptick now, to make the game even better. Now that I have the more ideas and people now, I have a whole new thread on Steam of how to improve battles, and people are. I mean, you should see some of these write-ups in there. They're like 5 pages long. With all, a lot of interesting suggestions. Some of them, like we talked about earlier, like make your game 3D. You know, as far as the future, it's really going to depend on how well Bedlam ends up doing, honestly. And like, we would really like to do a mobile version. You know, if the game starts going way north, which we hope it does at some point, you know, the time and energy will be there to do it. Because a lot of people have asked us, when's it going to be on mobile? And I think it's a perfect candidate for that type of platform. But we haven't really thought about past that. So we're just kind of just working on this and kind of keeping focused on, because our company pretty much lives and dies by one product, especially if you're an indie team.
Definitely.
You know, whether we do another Kickstarter in the future, really depends on what we come up with next. If we end up doing Bedlam 2, or whatever that ends up being,
that would
kind of dictate how and what we get the finances for to do the game.
Yeah, and as I was saying, I really do hope the best for you and to see these things improve, because again, you definitely are very passionate about Skylines Bedlam, and I think it really shows, and the consumers are seeing it, considering the work you've done with Redux and what you're continuing to do to make the game better and to go from, you know, stemming the bleeding to making things a lot better.
Yeah, and there's other games in the past, I think you mentioned one earlier, that kind of done this. And, you know, I just, even back in the day when I was doing those arcade games, I couldn't quit. Like, we'd make our own home version even, because we wanted to make it better than when it was released. Because back in the day, you could just go, here, patch your arcade machine, right? Because it cost money back then. You had to burn all new ROMs and stuff. So you're kind of, the game you made is the game you shipped with back in the day. But we always worked for fun on better versions. And those ended up becoming like the sequels, right? Like if ever Blitz 99 or Blitz 2000, they wouldn't be patches. They'd have to be new games back in the day.
Yeah.
Which is why I kind of did Redux mentality this way. It wasn't a new game, because we couldn't like get a new app ID on Steam and call it a different game, which I kind of wanted to do. Take rid of all the negative reviews, but Steam said they can't do that. It's not within their, you know, the, I forgot what, like, and then some legal thing.
Terms of service.
Like, we couldn't just call it Bedlam Redux with a new app ID and things like that. So it had to be an update kind of a thing.
Yeah.
Because I was trying to figure out ways of how to get rid of the reviews, because they don't, because part of the problem I have is a lot, even the negative reviews we still have aren't even about the game we have anymore. Like, if you look at the dates on those reviews, they're all from a week or two after we launched. And, you know, Steam doesn't have any way of saying, unless it's early access, of course, that this review only applies to this specific version of the game or something. So, I mean, we're being hurt by those reviews, and we can do nothing about it other than just keep trying to make the game better and hopefully drown those things out with more sales and more positive feedback.
Yeah. And I think another good point that I want to touch on before we start to wrap things up, because I think this is another big thing for developers to hear, is what you said a few minutes ago regarding now allowing players, or allowing your most hardcore, most vocal players, to play like the beta builds for upcoming patches of the game. Because we're seeing a lot more use of that. I know Darkest Dungeon did recently for their last update, to let players see before it goes official. And again, you get that feedback. You get to see how people are responding, and you can then take that before the game actually comes out. And it's just another way for developers to bring the community in to improve these games and to get those suggestions and that feedback that you wouldn't have gotten otherwise.
Yep. And it's a great way, especially the players who are vocal, they want to play it again.
Yeah.
And they want to love it. Like, they always tell us they want to love the game, but they can't because of this and this and this. I mean, you know, everybody wants to be a game designer, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that just goes without saying. So you kind of have to take something with a grain of salt. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, they have a lot of good ideas. And if they're really good game players and they find a flaw in the game, for example, like one of the players found a way to easily win battles. Mm-hmm. Well, guess what? I fixed that really quick, right?
Yeah.
Like, oh, I never thought of that. That's an interesting way of doing it. Mm-hmm. But it might have been a bug. I won't say if it was or not. Maybe it was. No bugs. But he found a really easy way to click on like an enemy, and then things went weird and kind of won a battle. And I'm like, oh. Mm-hmm. So when they can articulate it down to that level, mm-hmm. I want them to play it again and play any update we do, because they have very intelligible responses. Mm-hmm. And it's almost better than paying QA.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
For the game. Mm-hmm. So that you get real players playing the game.
Yep, and that's the same exact thing I hear from a lot of developers who go early access. You don't need to spend money on focus groups or QA when you have who knows how many hundreds, if not thousands, of eyes looking at your game, giving you suggestions and feedback that you can then use to make that product better.
Yeah, and that's, in fact, I do like the idea of early access. And you know, you asked me earlier, would I do it? And I'm like, it's mm-hmm. I want to do it. I'm just, you know, as I've always been afraid of the blowback, mm-hmm. would be too negative, then you can't get out from underneath it.
Yeah.
Kind of a thing. So it's one of those, once you do it, you can't take it back.
Exactly.
But if you don't do it, mm-hmm. you could always blame that you didn't do that.
Yes.
Right. So it's kind of like, if you want a fall guy, you don't go early access.
Mm-hmm. That's good. I mean, that's a great point. And the gas on it, too. That's good. All right. Again, I think we could sit here and talk more about Sky Shines Bellum. Who knows until 8 or 9 o'clock tonight my time. But I'm sure you need to get going. You have to get back to work on Sky Shines Bedlam. So,
and I got to implement that feature you mentioned.
Awesome. Can't wait to check it out. So we're going to wrap things up here. Jeff, it's been a pleasure talking today, and I think it's great to hear how things are slowly turning around. I would love to have you back on maybe in a few months, and hopefully you'll have some good news to share with how Sky Shines Bedlam has been growing since this podcast and since Redux.
I hope so too. That'd be awesome. I wouldn't be happier.
Great. So, for those of you listening to the cast, we're going to end things here for tonight. As always, if you'd like to support Game Wisdom, we have several options available. If you'd like to be a guest for a future podcast or write a guest piece for the site, you can find information and links under Submissions Wanted on the front page. I'm always looking for new guests, whether you're students, enthusiasts, or members of the industry. Just shoot me an email. If you'd like to donate to the ongoing Patreon campaign to keep Game Wisdom ad-free and let the content flow, you can find me on Patreon under Game Wisdom or by clicking that little Patreon banner on the front page, and any donations will be greatly appreciated. Last but not least, you can find me on Twitch and Twitter under GW Bicer. You can subscribe there to get the latest updates when new content goes up. And most of my videos, Let's Plays, and all that can be found on the Game Wisdom YouTube channel. So again, Jeff, it was great having you on tonight, and once again, I do wish you the best of luck. I can't wait to see how Sky Shines Bedlam continues to grow over the coming weeks or the coming months.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
Awesome. So again, thanks for tuning in, and have a great rest of the week, and we will talk to you again next time. Take care.